Welcome to today's deep dive. So we are looking at a massive urban problem that you might never have considered. I mean, what do you do with buildings designed purely to warehouse human labor?
Yeah, it's a huge question.
Right. So today we are taking you right into the heart of the 2009 South African National Housing Code, specifically the Community Residential Units or CRU program.
Which is just a massive undertaking.
Exactly. Our mission today is to unpack how this policy aimed to fix this staggering crisis. We are talking over 1 million neglected public hostel beds and, dysfunctional inner city buildings.
And it really is a logistical nightmare to even wrap your head around. Because, well, to understand why these buildings were failing, you have to look at their historical legacy.
Oh, for sure.
Under the old migrant labor system, I mean, these weren't normal apartments. They were massive, single-sex public dormitories. And they were built intentionally to keep workers isolated from the surrounding city.
Right, so they were never meant to accommodate families at all.
No, not at all.
And suddenly, you have an entire population of families trying to live in spaces built with communal bathrooms and like zero kitchens.
Which is just complete chaos.
Yeah, transitioning these structures into secure, integrated homes is wild.
Yeah.
It's like trying to rebuild an airplane mid-flight while figuring out who actually gets a seat.
That is a great analogy. And, the CRU had a very specific group of passengers in mind here. We're talking about households earning below 3,500 rand a month.
Which is really not a lot.
No, to put that 2009 number in perspective for you, it's incredibly tight margins. These households were making just enough to survive.
But far too little to afford the formal private rental market, right?
Exactly. And at the same time, they were entirely unserved by other social housing programs. They just fell right through the cracks.
The forgotten middle. Okay, let's unpack this. Because that specific income ceiling changes the entire math of the project.
It completely changes the approach, yeah.
Yeah, but here's where I really get hung up. I mean, wait, isn't the ultimate goal of public housing usually to transfer ownership to the residents? So they have a permanent asset?
That is the natural instinct, absolutely.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating here is that the CRU explicitly forbids selling this specific stock to individuals.
Wait, really? So they are just like perpetual renters?
Well, look closely at the mechanism of high-rise living. Let's say you transfer ownership of an apartment in a 10-story building to a family earning less than 3,500 rand a month.
Okay.
The moment the building needs, say, a new elevator or roof replacement or an overhaul of the main plumbing stack.
Oh, they get hit with a massive special assessment fee.
Exactly. They simply cannot afford that level of complex building maintenance. So individual ownership in that specific context actually becomes a financial trap that ruins them.
I see. So if they own it, they go bankrupt the second the boiler breaks.
Right. But if the province or municipality keeps ownership, they ensure a permanent protected pool of low-income rental stock.
That makes a lot of sense. It doesn't just get sold off to private developers down the line.
Precisely. The goal isn't immediate wealth generation. It is stability, giving them a safe foothold in the formal market.
Right, but that raises a massive logistical issue for the state. Like, how does the municipal landlord physically fix these deteriorating, varied properties without bankrupting itself?
Well, that is the big question. You can't just apply one blanket fix to a crumbling 10-story inner city block and, a sprawling single-story dormitory.
So, what does the intervention menu look like? Because I saw the document has incredibly detailed options.
Yeah, there are eight development options in total. It ranges from basic emergency triage.
Like just making sure the roof doesn't cave in.
Exactly. Basic stabilization. But then it goes all the way up to the complex demolition of multi-story buildings. But I really want to focus on option four, which is conversion.
Option four, conversion, right. That's taking those isolated single-sex dormitories we talked about.
Yes, they literally knock down the internal walls and carve out actual self-contained family flats with their own kitchens and bathrooms.
That is a massive overhaul. But wait, if the state is spending all this capital to convert the buildings and keeping ownership, how are they paying for the day-to-day upkeep?
Ah, well, that brings us to the strict cost recovery rent model.
Cost recovery.
Yeah, the state pays for the structural conversion up front, but the rent charged to the tenants must cover all operational costs.
Oh, wow. So tenant rent pays for the cleaning, security, fixing broken windows, all of that.
Exactly. The building has to be self-sustaining day to day. No relying on continuous government subsidies just to mop the hallways.
So what does this all mean? I mean, when you put it together, the CRU was a really pragmatic strategy. It retains public assets while providing these vital stepping stones into the formal housing market.
Definitely. And I think true knowledge comes from seeing how policies like this connect to the bigger picture of urban integration. It is about taking marginalized people and physically integrating them back into the city.
Using state-owned assets. But, you know, it leaves you with a pretty heavy question to chew on as we wrap up.
Oh, absolutely.
If a building's entire maintenance budget relies on a cost recovery rent model, and that rent is collected from households earning less than 3,500 Rand a month.
This is very fragile income.
Right. What happens to those communities when an unexpected economic shock hits those fragile incomes?
Something for you to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.